Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Spooky Shenanigans, your podcast for all things spooky, creepy, and downright strange. You are listening to myself, PJ, and my lovely co-host, who is also known as the resident believer, Nell.
Hello.
Hello. Now, in today's episode, we've been looking forward to this one for a while, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Just because of our American Horror Story love and love for all things New Orleans. And if you are a regular listener to the show, you'd have already caught one of our New Orleans episodes back on The Curse of Julia Brown. If you haven't, go back and listen to it. It's definitely worth a listen. This one is going a bit more, what's the best word to use? Psychotic?
Yeah, that's a pretty good word to use. Psychotic, gruesome,
disgusting,
stomach churning,
nauseating. Yeah, yeah, all of those lovely words to describe the person. Well, person's a bit of a stretch. That we are talking about today. You will know her from such shows as American Horror Story, Coven. Where, and I just want to caveat this because watching her on American Horror Story, and I'm going to give the game away now, I couldn't help but like her because it was Kathy Bates. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Kathy Bates just makes American Horror Story, doesn't she? Like,
she
no matter what role she plays.
Yeah, because let's face it, Roanoke was a bit of a disaster. It wasn't the greatest season, but she made it great with The Butcher. Oh, even though I don't know what accent she was trying to put on. But yeah, if you haven't guessed already, listeners, today we are covering the case of Madame Lalaurie. And if you're not used to, and this is episode 8, and also, yeah, I'm actually down in Southampton for this
Woo-hoo!
One. Woohoo! Nell and I still aren't in the same room doing it.
Soon, we do have plans soon.
Yeah, we do have plans for episode 9 to do that, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. So if you're not used to spooky shenanigans, the way it works is I do a brief intro to the case. And then Nell comes in and gives you all the details. And then we... and then it's a bit of a phenomenon. And again, if you don't get that, go back and listen to the last episode. But yeah, so let's jump into it. So like I said, today, episode 8, we are covering the case of Madame Lalaurie. And if you haven't heard of her... you're about to find out kind of sicko, twisted she was. So, cast your minds back to the lovely 18th century. And it was the late 18th century, and Madame Lalaurie, well, that's what she became. Nell will know the exact name, but she was born in America, and to a quite wealthy family. And wealthy because, yeah, you can imagine in that time period why people tended to get wealthy. It was through the ownership of plantations and subsequently, of course, slaves. Now, she was born into quite an interesting family. She managed to become a socialite because she loved drinking champagne. She loved being the talk of the town, and ultimately got a bit of a reputation because she ended up going through, I think, 3 husbands. the OG femme fatale, inheriting a lot of money because of her family's exploits, and then ultimately getting chased out of the place, New Orleans, because she was doing some disgusting things to her slaves. And when I say disgusting things, Like, I've got...
That's an understatement.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a strong stomach. I can watch some things, listen to some things and go, yeah, it's pretty gross. But some of these is just...
Yeah.
You know, and I love my true crime. I don't like the act of true crime.
I was just going to say.
Just want to tell the listeners that, you know, I'm not a burgeoning serial killer here. But I'm going to make an educated guess that if you're listening to this podcast, you also understand what I mean.
I was going to say, how's your relationship with your mother, PJ?
Actually really good. So I never abused animals. And though I did like to play with fire, so I suppose that's one of the three.
I mean, fire.
Yeah. I'm a fire starter. Twisted fire starter. Anyway, back to the case. So, yeah, she did some really twisted things. And again, more inspiration for Ryan Murphy. Mm. Yeah, there you go. That's Madame Lannery. What's your take, Lel? Come on, give us the deets.
Okay, well, settle in. Buckle up.
Because, we'll be here for 3 hours.
Boy, this is a hell of a case.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so, Madame Delphine Lalaurie was born Marie Delphine McCarthy on March 19th, 1787, to Louis Barthelemy McCarthy and Marie-Jeanne Lable. Now,
yeah, sorry, I'm just going to jump in there straight away. Sorry, listeners, I do this a lot, but March 19th, that makes her a Pisces, doesn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah, because I'm a Pisces, and I'm not doing myself any justice or favours here, but... Did you know, actually, Nell, that the highest proportion of serial killers are Pisces in history?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So be careful what you say to me.
Okay. That's very cool. Yeah, checking my windows before I go to bed tonight, just in case.
Well, I am in Southampton.
Oh, no. Now, listen, if you don't hear from me again...
Suspect number one. Anyway.
So, before PJ jumped in with that just now, I was going to say there are some rather complicated names in this case. So I shall do my very best to pronounce them properly. Don't come at me if I say them wrong, please. I will do my best. So, as I said, she was born to Louis Barthelemy McCarthy and Marie-Jeanne Lable, and they were a very affluent white Creole family. Mm. Her family had moved from Ireland to then Spanish-controlled Louisiana about a generation before she was born.
Okay.
And settled in America, and they were, like I said, very affluent and well-to-do. One of her uncles was a governor by the name of Esteban Rodriguez Miro.
And he was love the name Esteban. It's got a good ring to it.
I like that name.
Yeah.
And he was governor of the Spanish-American provinces of Louisiana and Florida during 1785 to 1791. Mm. And she also had a cousin called Augustine de McCarthy, who was mayor of New Orleans from 1815 to 1820. Mm. So, yeah, there's a lot of upper-class, well-to-do in that bloodline.
Yeah.
And her mother was known to be quite the prominent hostess, and she was also quite a prankster as well. records show that she loved having big flamboyant parties that often would go into the wee hours of the night regularly. And some nights would include guests jumping into the canal on their property and then having the clothes and shoes of the male guests stolen. So that would then, like, you know, force them to go home in bare feet and nightshirts. So,
oh, okay,
you know, quite a party going family there.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, jumping in there again. Did you say they used to jump into the water in Louisiana?
Yes. Yeah.
Alligators?
Well.
What? How drunk were they?
Probably pretty drunk, to be fair.
Yeah, and a few other choice substances as well. Because like we found out on the, what was it? The Bernie Mackey case. Sorry, not Bernie Mackey, but Ben, I'm thinking of your husband now. Bernie Mackey. The Bobby Mackey case. They discovered cocaine by then, hadn't they? Because of the dentists. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Anyway, stolen shoes.
Start with a good night, that.
Oh, yeah.
When you wake up and your shoes are gone.
Exactly. You wake up with all of your possessions, you didn't have a great night.
Absolutely. So, records show that quite a few of the Marcati men often entered into quite untraditional relationships with a few women of colour or mixed race.
Okay.
And back in those days, obviously we don't use the word in these times, but back then these were called quadroon relationships.
Right.
So Delphine's uncle had a 54-year relationship with a woman of colour, and as well as her cousins, associates, and even her father at one point also did. And the rules around like these kind of courtships were although it was kind of non-traditional, it was quite a popular thing, and although it wasn't frowned upon for men to enter into these kind of relationships, but one thing that they weren't allowed to do were marry.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, they could have these courtships, they could have the children, but they couldn't kind of make it all like quote legal official. And these women were referred to in the legal system as concubines. So, to be honest, that I don't like the word concubine. Like, for me, that has quite negative connotations.
Mm.
But, you know, it was what it was back then, I guess.
Standard practice throughout history, wasn't it?
Yeah. So...
Not that makes it right, of course.
Oh, gosh, no. Right. Also, back in those times, they had what was called the Black Code or the Code Noir. Okay. And this was introduced in Louisiana in about 1724. And this was kind of based on early codes developed in the French Caribbean colonies. And these were basically laws that kind of lined out what slaves and the slave masters were and were not able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And some people think that it was there to kind of almost like protect the slaves and give them like basic human rights, but I find that really questionable.
Mm-hmm.
Like reading through some of the articles, I mean, with this, there's like 60 articles in this, so
wow. You
I'm not going to go through all of them now because we'll be here forever, and some of them just, you know, aren't relevant to the episode. But some of them were basically lined up, like, you know, slaves who will not be fed, dressed, and supported by the masters will be able to tell it to our general public prosecutor and give him a report. If he receives several of such reports, he'll bring proceedings against his masters. And there'll be observed crimes and barbaric and inhumane treatments to their slaves. So basically, you know, that particular article is saying, you know, if they're not properly, you know, fed, dressed, etc., by the masters, then you'll be able to report it. But of course, you know, making reports like that then wasn't as easy as doing it in these days and times, you know. Mm-hmm. And another article goes on to say, slaves who are infirm due to age, sickness, or other reason, whether the sickness is curable or not, shall be nourished and cared for by their masters. In the case that they be abandoned, said slaves shall be taken to the hospital, to which their masters shall be required to pay for the care and feeding of each slave. Now, for me, like, when you first look at it, it kind of makes you think, okay, great. So, you know, it's making sure that they're being properly cared for, etc. Mm. But I mean, that doesn't make me feel, you know, like they're doing it to look after the slaves. They're doing it because they're kind of more protecting their assets rather than caring about the lives of these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I get that. So how long was this put in place before Madame Lalaurie's time then?
So this was introduced in Louisiana in 1724.
Oh, so a long time before
she was born.
Yeah.
And one particular law, which is very important to this, so bear this in mind. The masters may also, when they believe that their slaves so deserve, chain them and have them beaten with rods or straps. They shall be forbidden, however, from torturing them or mutilating any limb at the risk of having the slaves confiscated and having charges brought against them. Now, like I said, this is very important, this particular one, so bear that in mind.
Yeah, so listeners, you may have picked up the mutilation of. Yeah. So yeah, keep listening.
So like I said, yeah, there are a lot of articles that come under the Black Code. I'm not going to go through all of them, but these were just like a couple of them that kind of come into play, shall we say, later on in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
So, Delphine was married three times, as PJ already made mention previously. She entered into her first marriage when she was barely 14 years old.
Yep.
And, yeah, to me, that's absolutely crazy. 14. Like,
I know, it was really old in those days.
Wow, yeah. And she would marry a 35-year-old widower by the name of Don Ramon Lopez Angelo.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an officer of the Spanish Crown and second in command to the Louisiana governor.
Okay.
And so on June 11th of 1800, Don Ramon and Delphine were married in a private ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And now, Don Ramon, he had lost his wife on a voyage from Spain, and it's believed that he bore some kind of resentment towards the crown for this, because basically, I'm not sure whether it was a case of, like, the time of year was bad for sailing or just the weather in general, but he had basically asked the crown for a postponement for the trip. And this was denied. And as a result, his wife died on the way over. So, you know, he was feeling pretty pissed at this, as you can probably imagine. Now, one of the things that he had to do before marrying Delphine was to ask the permission of the crown. But apparently he got too impatient and went ahead and married her before the answer arrived. And a couple of weeks later, he gets the response. And it's no. Slightly awkward.
Oh, what was their reasoning?
I'm not sure. Like, I couldn't find, like, any, like, reasoning as to it when I looked into it. So, I don't know. But, yeah, the answer was no. Which, whoops, naughty, naughty boy. So, they make the voyage to Spain, and some can't say that he was kind of summoned there to kind of answer for this. And basically, this kind of act of rebellion basically cost him his position, and he was sent to France as, like, banishment, and he was given basically what was much like an office job.
Oh, yeah. Well, you don't get sent to France at that period, because that was just before the Napoleonic Wars. So, well, fortunately, well, you're going to say it anyway. he didn't live long enough for that.
Now, it said that upon kind of meeting Delphine in, like, the audience kind of thing that, you know, kind of the gentry had at that time, the Spanish queen was so taken with her beauty and her charisma and all that, that she basically offered her anything she wanted. She basically said, look, you're so beautiful and kind of well presented, etc. You know, tell me what you want to know, and I'll give it to you. And Delphine asked for Don Ramon to be pardoned.
Okay.
So, you know, there must have been at least, like, some form of us between them for her to do that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, unfortunately, January 11th of 1805, Don Ramon's vessel hits a sand dune or sandbar off the shores of Havana on the way home, and he was killed through this, leaving his pregnant wife waiting for his return.
Oh, she was pregnant?
She was.
Okay,
yes.
Sorry, I've got to jump in here now. So, number one, she was pregnant, and number two, he crashed off the shores of Havana, Cuba. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Guy just didn't want to be a father, and he lived off the rest of his days sick, drinking tequila in Cuba. Come on, let's be honest here. Oh, I see right through you, mate.
Literally, like, a couple of days after his death, Delphine gives birth to the daughter. So Delphine only remained in Havana long enough to have her husband put to rest and her daughter baptized. And after that, they both returned to New Orleans.
Hey!
Party town!
Mardi Gras!
So, after she returns, she quickly remarries. And on her 20th birthday, March 19th, 1807, she marries her second husband, Jean-Paul Blanc, who was an older Frenchman and widower.
Did you say Jean-Paul? Jean de Paul. Wow, he is old.
Now, Blanc was a ruthless businessman. He was a merchant, a banker, a lawyer, and by some reports, not exactly known for being involved in the most ethical activities. In fact, he was often associated with two notorious pirate brothers, Jean and Pierre Lafayette.
Oh, Lafayette, yeah, yeah.
Lafayette, that's it, yes. So, you know, some kind of questionable, shady dealings here and there, but, you know, it's... It is what it is, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so during their marriage, they purchased a two-story townhouse as well as the plantation house that Delphine had obtained from her mother's passing.
Mm-hmm.
So she has obtained some estate from it. As well as a hefty inheritance of $33,000.
Wow.
Yeah. So they would then go on and have five children, including obviously her first child from her previous marriage.
Yeah.
And the family were known to spend their time kind of between their townhouse and a plantation house. And, you know, from the outside perspective looking in, it looked like they lived, you know, quite a privileged, well-to-do life.
Oh, yeah.
Sadly, that was not the case at all. So, 10 years after the marriage, Jean Blanc passes away at 50 years old, leaving Delphine to his, quote, unquote, estate. This consisted of large amounts of debt, totaling to over $2.5 million in today's money.
Oh, in today's money, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And in order to
pocket change.
So in order to keep her own personal property and assets safe, she was forced to kind of give up the communal properties to the courts and forfeit all the mutual assets that they had together.
Yeah.
And she would also go on to spend the next 10 years trying to pay off all the debt that he's kind of racked up.
Mm. Yeah, I feel okay.
Yeah. However, when her father passed away in 1824, that left her a rather large inheritance. So I imagine she would, you know, kind of use some of that to pay a lot of it off.
Yeah, yeah, ideally.
1825, she would then meet her third husband, Dr. Louis Lorrie. Arriving from France. So he was a doctor and he specialised in like back problems and kind of like trying to solve like hunchbacks and things like that.
Okay.
And they met in 1836 when she took one of her children to him because apparently they had a crooked back. And this kind of led romance to bloom between the two of them.
I was just thinking, if he came over from France and he's a back doctor that worked on hunches.
Oh, I'm seeing where you're going with this.
Do you think he worked with Quasi? The bells.
Oh dear. Oh dear.
Hey, you never know.
I'm coming a mile away, really, shouldn't I?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Quasimodo's just as real as those ghosts, so. If Disney says so, then it's true.
Yes, dear. Of course, dear. Anything you say, dear.
I don't like your tone, Missy.
Wait, I need to check out the window. Make sure you're not there.
I'm always there.
Oh no. Look, I keep telling you, take the secret cameras down.
Anyway.
So, like I said, there was a courtship between the two of them, and he was actually significantly younger than Delphine. So by this time she would have been in like her mid to late 30s and he was in his 20s. So
that's off a tight one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, going for the upper man.
Yeah.
So, you know, this was quite rare in these days.
Mm.
And you know, records show that, you know, he would often write to his family back home in France and say, you know, oh, you know, I've met this woman, she's been showing me around town, blah blah blah, and you know, they were like, yeah, oh great, you know, well, kind of like, you know, keep her as a friend, you know, she seems like a good woman to know, blah blah blah. And it's unlikely that they'd known anything about the like the blossoming relationship between the two of them.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Delphine soon becomes pregnant with his child outside of wedlock.
Ooh.
Yeah, which, as we know from previous episodes, this was not a good thing.
No, that was very, very naughty.
Oh, yeah. However, he does the quote-unquote right thing and marries her.
Oh, what a good lad.
Yes, indeed. And unfortunately, however, this marriage was not a happy one at all. They spent very little time together, and when they did spend time together, there was often seen to kind of fight and bicker and argue a lot. And a letter written by a nearby neighbour to a friend in 1828 describes the Lawlery marriage as, they do not have a happy household. They fight, often separate, and then return to each other, which would make one believe that someday they will abandon each other completely.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. On November 16th, 1832, Delphine would then go on to send a petition to the courts asking for a separation from the bed and board of her husband on a claim that he treated her poorly and even beat her once in the presence of witnesses.
Okay.
So, like I said, not a very happy partnership.
No.
At all. And it was around this kind of time that rumours would start circulating around the New Orleans community and high society about the way that Delphine Lawlery would treat her slaves.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now, on the kind of like in public, she would seem to be generally quite polite to them.
Yeah.
However, a lot of the time, many New Orleans residents would recount that her slaves were often seen as haggard and wretched in appearance.
Mm.
So, you know, things are brewing. Things are brewing.
Yeah, well, she had some big balls to, you know, host these events where she knew that the people in the community would be attending, and she knew that her slaves would be involved in that hosting with, you know, serving food and drinks, and so very callous, you know.
Absolutely.
So, I don't care if you see how badly I treat my slaves, you know. It's like, wow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, apparently during these parties, she would often be seen to be like giving her those like small drinks of wine and stuff.
Oh, I heard this, yeah.
Almost like a front of, oh, you know, all the rumors are just a pack of lies. Look how well I'm treating them. You know, I'm letting them have drinks and all that. It's, yeah, very callous.
Yeah.
So, in the span of about 4 years, 12 slaves were registered with her, and like it, or like with her household. And typically, you know, if a slave were to die, then obviously, you know, those have to like register that with the appropriate authorities. But the causes of the deaths were never mentioned, which is suspicious as all hell.
Yeah, that is really suspicious. It's like, oh, one of my slaves died. Okay, we'll just put that in there. Don't you want to know why? Nope. So why even collect that data?
Exactly. And in fact, at one point, the rumours of her mistreatment spread through the town so quickly and so loudly, it actually resulted in a lawyer being sent to the mansion in order to, like, kind of remind her of the laws behind keeping slaves.
She had money. She didn't need to abide by the laws.
Well, we'll get into that.
I know. That was a strategic comment.
And he would also take this opportunity to kind of, you know, have a look around and stuff like that to find, like, any kind of evidence for this. However, he couldn't find any. And apparently he was also quite taken with her, you know, like, charisma and charm, and so he just kind of wrote it all off.
Yeah, her charisma, uniqueness, nerve and talent.
And
oh, don't tell me you didn't get that now.
I can't say I did, no.
What does it spell? The first letters. Charisma, uniqueness, nerve and talent.
Oh, God.
Any Drag Race, RuPaul Drag Race fans out there will get it.
I mean, to be fair, that, yeah, that sums up fairly well, I think.
That is a perfect description of her.
Oh, yeah. So, not long after this, there would be an incident where a young girl by the name of Leah was brushing her mistress's hair one evening, and the brush caught a snag as she was brushing it. Now, you know, it's hair, like, you know, it tangles.
Yeah.
However, this absolutely enraged Delphine, and she reached for a bullwhip and started beating this girl. Now, bearing in mind, this girl is 12 years old.
Yeah.
You know, and she goes to run from the room to escape this beating, at which point then Delphine chases her around the house and up to the roof. And it's unclear whether Leah jumped from the roof or slipped, but either way, she falls and is killed by the impact.
Yeah.
And Delphine then buries the body in the grounds in the hopes of, you know, kind of keeping it all hush hush.
Yeah.
However, she was seen by a neighbour who then reports this, luckily.
Yeah.
And this leads to an investigation, and they're ultimately found guilty of illegal cruelty, and as well as a fine of something like, I think it was like $300. They were also forced to forfeit one of their slaves, which on the one hand is good. However, unfortunately, like you've said before, PJ, she had money and she had influence. Mm-hmm. And yeah, her family literally bought these slaves back and brought them back to her.
Yeah, that's, oh Christ.
Which is absolutely horrific.
Yeah. Imagine feeling the relief of escaping that place finally. You know, mm-hmm. you see the sunlight, you've got hope of you're going to be owned by someone else, but they could be lovely, they could be, really look after you, you could, you know, live out your days in a decent household, to then find out that you're going right back. You're going
right back, yeah.
To hell.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And to be
honest, after that, they would have probably been treated even worse.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, you know.
Yeah, because even though it wasn't their choice to leave, you know, she would have taken her anger out on them.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt.
And she had a temper.
Oh, yeah. So, April 10th, 1834, the kind of climax of this story. A fire breaks out at the LaLaurie mansion, and police and fire marshals and the residents in the community rush to, you know, go and put it out and help get people out and the furniture and nothing like that.
Yeah.
And it's from that a 70-year-old woman of colour who was the cook was chained to the sofa by her ankle, and she admits to being the one who purposely started the fire, and she did this as a suicide attempt. And yeah, when she was asked, you know, why would you do this kind of thing, she says it would be to avoid being taken up to the third floor.
Oh.
Because it was said that slaves who were taken up there never came down again.
Oh.
Yeah. So, during this evacuation, the community asked the LaLauries for the keys to the slaves' quarters so, you know, they can get them out as well. At which point then, her husband, Louis, is quoted as saying, "There were those who would be better employed if they would attend to their own affairs instead of intermeddling with the concerns of other people."
Okay.
In other words, mind your own business.
Yeah.
At which point then, the people go to the judge, who give the order to break down the door. And it's at this moment that the true horrors of the LaLaurie mansion come to light. Now, there are kind of mixed reports as to what were really found there. Yeah. However, the bulk of the story was that several slaves were found imprisoned there, some strapped on tables, others were chained to walls, they were hung by their necks. Some were in iron collars with the like the spikes digging in to their flesh to prevent them from moving too much. They're found naked with worms digging in and wriggling in their open flesh wounds from whip marks. Their legs and arms were torn and stretched abnormally. Many were starved, and it was pretty clear that they'd been there for a long time. Some had been saved with a whip. Others were bound in restrictive postures with spiked iron collars. And it's also said that there were several deceased bodies there as well, which, yeah, now to me that kind of tells me that they were there to kind of show the other slaves, look, this is your fate. Some kind of, like, you know, like mental torture as well as physical.
Yeah, I can appreciate that, but also I think it's just, I'd say it'd be more just the Lollaries just total disregard of the humanity of these people. You don't deserve to be buried. Oh, you're dead. We'll just leave you there. We don't care. We just torture the rest of you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a mixture of the two, like, you know, it's more than probable.
The thing is, though, if I was in that situation, I'd want to die. So, I mean, seeing that there, you'd be like, I'm so jealous. You've escaped this torture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The dead are the lucky ones in this case.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, like I said, you know, there are some reports that the torture was even more extreme than what I've just mentioned. I mean, to be fair, that's really pretty damn extreme to me. Like,
yeah, you know,
at the end of the day, torture is torture.
Yeah, that is twisted.
You know, so some of the reports say that they were beaten, bruised, and bloodied to within an inch of their lives, their eyes gouged out, skin flayed, and mouths filled with excrement and then sewn shut. One particularly disturbing report claims that there was a woman whose bones had been broken and reset so that she resembled a crab.
Oh, what the fuck?
Yeah, and there are also apparently people with holes in their skulls that have been drilled in with wooden spoons near them that would be used to stir their brains.
That seems a bit mad.
It does. Like I've said, you know, this was 200 years ago. Reports vary, you know, it's difficult to know what is accurate and what was, like, you know, kind of embellished on for the papers and stories for, like, you know, like the tourist attractions in these days. But, you know, like I said, torture is torture. Like, it's horrific any way you slice it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, being a slave is torture enough, isn't it? So,
well, yeah, absolutely.
Doing all that extra stuff to them. Ugh.
After the stories of her crimes had spread through the town, a mob of angry residents were so incensed by this, they attacked the mansion. And they basically made it their personal mission to absolutely destroy anything that they could get their hands on.
Yeah, and that was all races, all social classes. Oh, yeah. You know,
Now, can you imagine, you know, some of these would have been fellow slave owners. How bad would it have had to have been for even other slave owners to say, whoa, that's, you know, completely abhorrent.
Yeah, I know.
You know, to add insult to injury, the slaves that had been found on the third floor, instead of, you know, kind of being taken to safety and having, you know, their wounds healed and cleaned and like that, they were then taken to the police station where they were available for public viewing.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah.
And it says that 4,000 people had come to kind of gawk at these poor individuals to, quote unquote, convince themselves of suffering.
That's some sick catharsis, that is.
It is.
I can imagine them, like, yep. Hi, I've still got a hole in my head with maggots eating my brain. Can I go to the hospital, please?
Right? Like, it's just, yeah.
You got to remember, this is a sick society that still enjoyed watching public executions, you know, it's...
Yeah, true.
And they loved the macabre.
They did, but it still boils my blood.
Yeah, boils my blood as well. I'm not giving them excuses.
Good.
This is just how it was back then, you know?
It's
normal for them. So,
investigators would then go on to, like, you know, kind of explore more of the house. And it said that they were actually some bodies buried in the floors.
Ugh.
Of the house as well. Several bodies were found throughout the matching grounds, including that of a child, which, you know, would kind of back up the Blia story.
Yeah, and also the cook, because I read that she had some children who also died while under the ownership of the Lalaurie's.
Oh, really?
Mm, so it could have been them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that would put you over the edge as a parent, wouldn't it?
Oh, wouldn't it just?
You'd want to burn the bitch.
Oh, yeah.
I've just got Angela Lansbury in my head now from American Horror Story.
Oh, amazing. Queen. Another amazing actress.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah. So, infuriatingly, Adelphine never... was brought to justice for her crimes. She and her family escaped to Paris from New Orleans and basically never looked back.
Oh, I mean, come on, that is punishment in itself, having to live in Paris. Woo! No thanks.
Hey, what's wrong with Paris?
Oh, no, no, no.
Wee, wee, wee.
Oh, no, no. Give me Normandy any day. People are real. Lovely, lovely.
No, anyway. I love Paris. Anyway, we're going slightly off topic here. Like I said, Delphine lived out her days in Paris, and eventually she and Louis would end up separating, and he would relocate to Havana.
Yeah, he ran off with an ex-husband who didn't actually die, and they ended up in a relationship.
Apparently, based on that consent, but to her son, it's believed that she had planned to return to New Orleans, but her family had kind of greatly disapproved of this. I can't think of any reason.
Yeah, probably.
It's really difficult to figure out.
Yeah, you'll either be arrested and hanged publicly, and that's the nice way out, or the baying bloodthirsty mob will tear you limb from limb. Which do you prefer?
Yeah, choice is yours, you know.
Yeah.
So she would pass away in Paris December 7th, 1849, age 62. And like I said, she never answered for her crimes. Since then, the house has been a number of different things. It's been a girls' school, it's been a homeless shelter, a furniture shop, a private residence, and even a pub at one point. And the owner kind of capitalized on its kind of creepy reputation by calling it the Haunted Saloon, which, you know. Why wouldn't you? You know.
Oh, yeah.
In April 2007, the house was also purchased by actor Nicolas Cage for $3.45 million.
I was going to say, I love Nick Cage, so I'm so glad. That's definitely the sort of energy of house that he would buy, so I'm not surprised by that.
However, sadly, 2 years later, the property was listed for auction because apparently he kind of suffered financial difficulties. And so it was listed for auction as a result of foreclosure.
Yeah. Still owned by the bank now, isn't it?
Today it's a private residence, apparently. Or like a holiday home kind of thing, or a second home for someone wealthy.
Oh, yeah, I forgot I bought it. Just go around buying it. Oh, my gosh, we should do that. Set up an investment fund, a real estate investment fund that just buys creepy old houses with, like, this sort of historical significance like this.
Oh, I'll be up for that.
We could call it the Ghostus Interruptus Fund.
Yes, absolutely.
He hasn't interrupted us in a while, has he?
He hasn't, no.
Where are you?
He's on a boat.
So rude.
Absolutely. So, as with, you know, kind of a lot of these old, creepy places with a dark past, the mansion has its fair share of ghost stories. As you can probably imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Stories of doors slamming, faucets suddenly turning on and off, and furniture moving on its own. Body imprints are found on beds that no one has slept on, and apparitions have often been seen. And at one point, when the building was kind of between being one thing and something else, someone broke in, you know, looking for somewhere to spend the night, and apparently was attacked by an invisible force.
Okay.
Which, honestly, if anywhere was going to be haunted, it would absolutely be this place.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, the amount of evil that happened behind its walls, and like, even if it wasn't like out and out hauntings, you know, there must be some kind of dark imprint on the place.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd definitely be a conduit for dark energy.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, I will die on that hill. Absolutely. It's, yeah, if anywhere deserves to be haunted, it's the LaLaurie Mansion.
Perfect. We're going there then. And I'm going to do a live stream and be like, yep, no one's here. Was it? What up, demons? It's your boy PJ.
Yeah. Whoosh. Watch PJ fly across the room.
No, and it'll all be on a rigged set with wires and ropes and stuff. Or I might see an orb of light like they usually do. Hey, you never know, Derek Okora might come through the other side.
No. I mean, to be honest, it makes me sad, the thought that, you know, the spirits of these slaves might still be there today, like, after everything they went through in life.
Mm.
You know, I would hope that they would find some peace on the other side.
Yeah, or it could just be like the haunted house in the first American Horror Story, where as soon as it's destroyed, that's it. They can move on. Was it destroyed or were they dug up? I can't remember.
I can't remember. It's been a while.
It was the fire, wasn't it? Yeah, the fire cleansed. So maybe when the cook set the place on fire, it cleansed all the spirits and they all left. There you go.
End of story.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you know as well? Sorry, slightly off topic, but the house that features in the first season of American Horror Story, you can actually rent as an Airbnb now.
Oh, yes.
Right? How cool is that?
Right, let's go.
Yeah, I'll meet you at the airport.
So thanks for that, Nell, and thanks for listening, listeners. Usually this is the part where we tend to give our own opinions, but where it's one where it's based in historical fact and it's more around a psycho killing people and torturing them than any ghosts or people knocking on walls and pretending to be ghosts, then we've sort of already done a lot of commentary on it. But I just want to say thank you very much for tuning in again. You know, we've, even though this is only episode 8, we have seen our audience growing and our returning audience. And we feel so blessed and thankful for everyone who does stay tuned in, because I mean, it speaks volumes. You know, you clearly must like it, otherwise you won't be listening again.
And you know, honestly, it blows my mind a little bit. Like every time we kind of, you know, kind of get another download update, or you know, we get the feedback from people who have just listened to our latest episodes, and it's just, thank you so much, you guys. It's it really means a huge amount.
It does. Thank you. It just puts the extra pressure on us then to make sure it's always as good. But it's great when we look at the locations, you know, and it's not just in the UK. We're getting people from Canada, from the Netherlands, from France, from
India,
the United States, India, even from the Czech Republic. It's like, wow, how did you stumble on us?
And Australia, and you know, it just, you guys are amazing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There, you've been listening to Spooky Shenanigans, your podcast of all things spooky, creepy, and downright strange. If you do like the topics that we discuss, the cases that we discuss per episode, then you know, you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel, which we've now set up, so Spooky Shenanigans, where at the moment this season we're just uploading the audio, but some people prefer to still look at something while they're listening, so we've given you that option. Also, for some alternatives, you can check out mine and Nell's channels as well. Mine is Serial Chillers and Nell's is Nell's Crypt. But thank you very much. You've been listening to me, PJ,
and me, Nell,
and as usual, thank you very much for listening and stay
spooky.
Bye.
Bye.